Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Hey, Mets fans, welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. I am Brian. Thank you for joining me this week. Chris can't be here this week, so we've called in a member of the bench, a longtime friend of the site, formerly of USA Today, formerly of SNY. We were just discussing the late, great, mostly Mets podcast. We have Ted Berg on the show today. Hello, Ted.
Brian, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure.
So, I hope so. We'll see. We'll see. Maybe it'll be like arduous. You know, it could be difficult.
I had a really good sandwich later. I'm going to run by you. So we have at least some good content.
I'm probably better suited to speak about sandwiches than the Mets at this point. But we'll see what comes out.
So, you know, myself and a lot of other folks in my shoes found your writing and your podcasting about the Mets. And it's been a couple of years since you've been writing about the Mets extensively. You've been covering baseball on a more national level. So for folks who maybe didn't get to read what you wrote about the Mets this season, or just, you know, for our listeners who need a refresher, what did you think of the 2019 season? What were some of the highlights for you?
Oh, man. I mean, it was surprisingly fun. So it's honestly, if I'm being honest, baseball was sort of complicated for me this year just because I knew I was in the process of first being miserable and then going on to lose my job. So it was really only once I left my job that I was like, man, wait, I love baseball. Like, I really like baseball. And I started watching the Mets every night again. I had been writing a newsletter that required that I wake up at 5 a.m. And as it turns out, that's not a great way to watch sports if you need to be up at 5 a.m. and also have a toddler at home. So I really, like, I feel bad to say this, but I guess I can admit it now. Like, I felt like such a poser because I was writing about so many different sports things that I just wasn't watching at all. We try to keep my kid away from the TV. So, you know, he doesn't go to bed until 8:30. So I'd have like a 45-minute window to watch Mets games, and then I'm falling asleep on the couch. So it wasn't really until mid-August that I started being able to watch full Mets games again. And man, they were a fun team. I picked up enough of it to know that. But like, in seeing all those games, like, what a good group of position players they have right now. Like, a good young core. It feels like it happened so. For Mets fans, it's not quietly. But for, I guess, on the in terms of like the national landscape, it's not like, you know, you think back to like the way the Astros are, where like the Astros had all these guys, and every single one that came up, Altuve and Correa and Springer, were all big, big deals. And it feels like, you know, outside of a little bit Pete Alonso, none of these guys was like a mega prospect, right? It's just like, just, you know, now Jeff McNeil is here and he's a really good major league player, and Brandon Nimmo, and you know, not that he had a great year, and J.D. Davis is going to hit however many home runs. And so it just seems to me like such a nice core of players to have moving forward that I'm psyched. Like, and that's in spite of myself because I should know better, but I'm psyched. I'm psyched about the Mets.
Yeah, I have one of my cousins married a big, big Yankee fan. And in May or June, we were at a family barbecue and he pulled me aside and was like, who the fuck is Pete Alonso? Like, I never heard of this guy. How is he doing this? And I was like, yeah, it's just, you know, people thought he'd be good, but he's, you know, he's really good. And he says, and then McNeil, that guy can really hit. I said, yeah. And he goes, and Davis. And he just kept rattling off these players that he was not familiar with, just like what you're saying, you know? And I think that as Mets fans, we got spoiled by the the Harvey, Wheeler, DeGrom, you know, progression of prospects actually working out, that it doesn't feel as weird for us to have position player prospects work out because we had pitching prospects work out. But it's pretty weird to have 6 or 8 of your last 15 top prospects actually come to fruition.
Yeah, and all guys, like especially McNeil and Alonso, guys I think were sort of off the radar nationally. But if you look at the numbers, they were always good. Like McNeil hit at every single level. And, you know, they sort of it's sort of the same thing like going back to like Sabermetrics 1.0, you know, and I think that a lot of the way prospects are covered on the internet has almost swung back towards the scouting side of things. But with all these guys, like if you just looked at the numbers, I think you could have seen it coming. Pete Alonso hit a ton of home runs in the minors last year, and that was before they were using the juice ball.
Yeah, absolutely. Was there sort of one player that you particularly got behind this season? Like for me, this was the year of J.D. Davis. Trade. It was a trade nobody really wanted. He seemed like an extra piece, but then all of a sudden, like, well, this guy is amazing, and he seems like he's having fun, and so that was my guy. Did you have a guy?
See, I was going to say J.D. Davis as well, because J.D. Davis was kind of a guy I always was into before, honestly, before he came to the Mets. Just it fascinates me that the Astros just they've had so many good players that these guys just get buried in their system who are clearly major league players. Colin Moran is kind of another guy like that. And it just feels like, you know, they're in this spot where like it almost, the development, I would guess, like it almost like flips. Like at some point it becomes a hindrance because a guy gets to AAA and he's got nowhere to go. And so and even in the Astros system, it was like a guy gets to AA and he has nowhere to go because they're so stacked at the major league level. What always intrigued me about Davis, on top of the fact that he had good minor league numbers, is that he was a college pitcher and he can throw in the 90s. And so I had always kind of I don't know. It was an article I planned on writing and never wound up writing. But there's a bunch of position players out there who pitched some in college, and I kind of have the idea that I think there's probably more value, and I think it's probably the type of thing that will come around because we saw so many position players pitching this year that teams will start carrying guys to be sort of your position player utility mop-up man, like a 25th man on the roster who can do a little bit of everything, including throw, you know, 90 and throw strikes over the plate and let him hit it and have an 8 ERA, because sometimes you need a guy to throw two innings with and allow, you know, one run or two runs. And so that was honestly like what sort of appealed to me about Davis. But then watching him play as much as I did late in the season, I mean, the guy can hit, and he's just there's something charismatic about his persona, I guess. I didn't realize while watching exactly how the defensive metrics treated him. Like you could sort of see it. And again, it's like a part season of defensive metrics, so I don't really know what that's worth, but it does sort of pass the eye test with him, where he's not a great defensive player. But that's all right. I mean, the guy can hit.
Yeah. And in addition to J.D. Davis, I think that one of the really nice things about this season overall was that you were seeing guys who weren't supposed to succeed at this level succeed at this level, like Dom Smith being the prime example there. Dom Smith was an afterthought 2 years ago and was really an afterthought now, but all of a sudden, Dom Smith is you know, a productive player. He gets hurt, that's a bummer, and then the walk-off at the end of the season, just a fantastic story. And it seemed like in every corner of the Mets, there were those type of stories this year. I recently described this season to a friend of mine as like the most fun season I can remember where the Mets didn't make the playoffs.
I think that's fair. I think it's these like sort of young homegrown players playing well. Dom Smith, man, like I would watch like a second screen of the Mets broadcast that was just watching Dom Smith watch the game. Like, it was just, that was, it always seemed like he was right in the thick of all of it. It seemed like, I mean, he couldn't have handled that better. Like, if you think about his situation, like, he was the guy. He was the Mets' top prospect. He was supposed to be the first baseman, and he got, you know, he got leapfrogged, obviously. And instead of being sour about it, which I certainly would be, he was just like totally cool about it, and seemed like completely happy to sort of be there and be the, you know, pinch hit guy and play some outfield and fill in for Alonso when he missed. And man, like, it made it again really fun.
Yeah, and you know, Smith also had that altercation, it's a strong word, with Mickey Callaway when Callaway first got there, that he was late to a team meeting, and just, you know, he seemingly had five or six opportunities to pack it in, and nobody would have really blamed him for packing it in on his Mets career. But he never did that, and thank goodness he didn't. Just super fun.
Yeah, I'm so glad. It seemed like such an obvious trade candidate, too, and I'm so glad they didn't trade him. I hope they don't trade him. I know that's sort of silly because they have so many corner players, but I like this one. I like this guy. I want to see him if you can find him 300 at-bats a year, you know, and he's a good hitter.
And with the 26th man coming on the roster, it eliminates some of the crunch for him.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That's a good point.
Yeah. So yeah, you know, one of the things that we like to do on this podcast is to say how right we are when we're right about things. And both Chris and I had been really pulling for Carlos Beltran as the next manager of the Mets. And you are a longtime Beltran supporter slash blamer. And I say that with the tongue firmly in cheek. So what do you think about Beltran as the new Mets manager?
I am deeply conflicted. I guess this sounds so lame to say, but like, I said it jokingly to Cerrone on Twitter when he asked me about it, but like, it's kind of true. Like, I'm happy if Carlos Beltran's happy. Like, if this is what he wants, then good. Like, good. Then, like, great. Yes, Carlos Beltran has done enough for me by playing baseball and being so awesome at it that I want him to be happy. And if he wants to be the manager of the Mets, then, you know, good. Then I'm happy that he's the manager of the Mets. But I have been a Mets fan long enough to know how this ends. We all know how this ends. And it's not with Carlos Beltran retiring at 76 years old with a gold watch and 15 World Series rings, you know, and a Hall of Fame as a player and a manager, right? That's not how this ends. And so I don't want... I'm gonna try not to let this happen, but it's like, I don't want Carlos Beltran, the manager, to color my memories of Carlos Beltran, the baseball player, because those are perfect. And so, you know, I don't like now he's going to be this other thing. Now he's going to be this guy I get mad at when he pulls out a mysteriously timed bunt. And you know, he's going to pull out a mysteriously timed bunt because even in his best seasons as a baseball player, he did that sometimes. And so, yeah. So again, it's like this sort of powerful ambivalence about it, where it's like, yeah, I'm happy. That's awesome. Love Carlos Beltran. Like, I want him to have this, and I want him to do well. And I think he's a smart guy, and like, I think he really does connect with the young players. And I think that I think it's a good hire. I don't think that there's, everyone's experience and all these different things. And, oh, you can't go back to an inexperienced guy because of Mickey Callaway. Well, look, it worked out fine with Aaron Boone. It's worth, there's a, you know, a dozen examples of it being okay to hire an inexperienced manager. So I don't think that's the issue. I think it's, you know, person by person situation. I think he'll be good at it. I just don't think that there's anyone who's going to have that job forever. And so at some point, the Mets are going to fire Carlos Beltran, and that's going to suck.
Yes, it will. But, I mean, so we were talking about this a couple weeks ago. Would you say the last good Mets manager was Bobby Valentine?
No. I mean, I think – I honestly, like, I don't know. I think that there's – I think that strategic managing is such a small portion of what it really is. You know, I think that it's just so much people management. I think that obviously I care, you know, and it angers me when it feels like a guy's like doing what Terry Collins did to Scott Rice or any of these guys that just get destroyed by overuse out of the bullpen. I thought Terry Collins was a good manager. I thought like it seemed like for when it was going well, it felt like the players really liked him. Like he was able to get the most out of him, out of them. Strategically, he always left a lot to be desired. But I thought, I mean, you know, he made the World Series, and so I would say, you know, and you can say, well, he had a great team. He did. There's always chicken and egg to it, but I thought he was a fine manager.
That's interesting. I mean, you also have spent far more time in big league clubhouses than I have, so I'm sure you have a different sort of level of import that you put on certain things than someone like me who hasn't spent a lot of time in a clubhouse would feel.
I guess. I mean, I think that, you know, you still don't see the manager really interacting with the players all that much. Like, you see a little bit of it, but I still miss the bulk of it. I think one of the things I liked about Terry Collins was just, like, how, and this was something from what I understand that he did not do in his tenure in Anaheim, but just like how earnestly he was trying to protect his guys, at least publicly, you know, forward facing, I think is something the players are really into. Like, and I think that it's sort of the opposite of like Jerry Manuel would just throw guys under the bus. And if you throw enough players under the bus, then the players don't want to play for you anymore. And I felt like, and from my perspective, and it's not, you know, it's informed, but it's not like I've ever been a beat writer or anything. So there people know way better than me. But it always seemed like Terry Collins like genuinely cared for his players and genuinely did want to maintain a good relationship with them and, you know, do right by them. Whether he made the right calls out of the bullpen every time is there's, you know, there's some questions there. But I always thought he seemed like a good guy.
Yeah, and I think that for the most part, you know, bringing this back to Beltran, I think that Beltran, as a former player, will probably have a good perspective on what a manager is supposed to do for his players. So, you know, I feel good about that. I also think, and, you know, not to keep piling on Mickey Callaway, but Callaway was a terrible tactical manager, a terrible manager with the press, and, you know, I can't speak to how he was as a manager of players. But I will say that from an outsider's perspective, I think that even on a year when the Mets did pretty well, everybody recognized how bad of a manager Callaway was. And so Beltran's going to have a longer leash than he would have if he was coming in right after Collins or right after Willie Randolph or anybody that had some sort of success with the team, because Callaway was just that poorly regarded.
I think that's fair. I think he also gets a longer leash for being a Hall of Fame caliber baseball player. Like, I think there's just like a level of respect there. And I don't know that should be the case, but I think that it's like, well, this is Carlos Beltran. Like, this guy has to know what he's talking about, right? Like, there's only so low your baseball IQ can possibly be to be that good of a baseball player. And I, you know, obviously you saw him play. Like, he had an extraordinarily high baseball IQ. He was always, you know, very smart on the field. I thought there were two times he didn't slide. People will remember that forever. But other than that, you know, probably it was because his knees were falling off at the time. It always seemed to me like he, you know, very, very aware of what was going on, very aware of the situations. I think he'll be fine. I mean, I think he'll be good. And I think you're right. I think that he will get a fairly long leash. And I think he'll have a pretty, you know, if they make the right moves this offseason, I think he'll have a good team. And that tends to make things a little bit easier on a manager.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know about you. I was very surprised that he was even willing to take this job because of how the Mets organization seemingly ran him out of town. But he handled a lot of grace, you know, when he asked about it.
Yeah, he did. I think that he wants to live in New York. He wants to stay in New York. I think he wants to manage, and I think he sees that The other job's not going to be available anytime soon. So I think it's like sort of like, oh, well, this is the one that makes sense. If you're not going to move and you want to be a manager, then you either wait until the Yankees fire Aaron Boone and hope to step in then, or you take this job with a team you know in a place you've been before and where it's like sort of the devil you know, right? Like, you know who Carlos Beltran, and there's a lot was sort of made about this going into it. Like, he knows what he's getting into. It's not going to be a surprise when the Mets stuff starts happening.
Right. And I do wonder how much of this is possible because of having Omar Minaya there as a buffer again. You know, obviously he and Omar had a good relationship when he was playing for him. And I wonder if Omar being in the front office is just a comfort for Beltran as well.
I believe that. I think that Minaya has even a little more pull now than he did when they first brought him back. From what I understand, that's like sort of third hand knowledge. But I'm not surprised by that. Like, yeah, I think that that's part of it. I think Baird also is a guy Beltran has a good relationship with. Yep. So they probably, you know, sort of maybe gently swayed the Wilpons. Like, hey, by the way, this guy was like really smart and a good mentor to the younger players and a good dude. And also, just for what it's worth, completely worth his contract that you said you were a sucker for signing. So, you know, maybe we should revisit this guy that we, the patient zero for Mets medical, whatever they do, you know, like it, when they had the whole thing with him getting knee surgery and they didn't want him to get knee surgery. He was right. Right. Like, if you look at the course of his career after that, like, he was clearly right. And so, yeah, maybe it was Omar Minaya. That's cool. That's like a fun twist to the Omar Minaya tenure in New York.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, just speaking of Minaya, we also, at least when I say we, I mean me, I tend to forget he was in the front office in 99 and 2000 also. So Omar Minaya has really been involved with a real interesting run of Mets teams.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the Wilpons, say what you will about them, they, for better and for worse, are extremely loyal people. And, you know, if they find a guy they like, they are going to ride or die with that guy. It has often gotten them in trouble, got them in trouble with Bernie Madoff, got them in trouble with Tony Bernazard. You know, Omar Minaya is their guy, and it has worked out fairly well. You know, he put together one team that nearly made the World Series and seems like now a trusted advisor at the very least.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, if the Mets do the right moves this offseason, Beltran will have a potentially good first season. Are there any particular things you're looking for the team to do aside from fix the bullpen? Because we all know they have to fix the bullpen and get a fifth starter. But in terms of anything specific, is there a player you really want them to go after? Is there a strategy you want them to approach? You know, what are you thinking about for this offseason?
You think they have to fix a bullpen?
I mean...
I think they need a Juan Lagares type who's better than Juan Lagares, right? Like, that would be a really big thing, I think. Like, I don't think you need a... I think that there's almost too much of a crowd to say, like, oh, we need our new everyday nine-inning center fielder. I think you need, like, a plus-plus defensive outfielder to be your fourth outfielder. So, like, that's not that hard a thing to find, right? Like, is Jared Dyson available, or the current version of like Jared Dyson 5 years ago? It feels like you should be able to go get that. The lineup is like, I don't know, it's good. I don't know where else you're really looking to like to upgrade offensively. I think obviously defense, they have some gains to make, and then I would just say bringing in as much like bulk pitching talent as you can, right? Especially if Wheeler's leaving, you're going to need innings. It's not Gesellman, and I think you'd rather have Lugo in the same exact role he worked in last year as one effective bullpen man. And so, yeah, like you just it's obviously pitching, but I think offensively, I don't know where do you upgrade?
You know, that's a question I've been thinking about a lot. I think that the only place that seems like a logical or an obvious answer is an almost impossible place to upgrade, and that's backup catcher. You know, if right. they could, if they could have somebody who's not an offensive black hole as the backup catcher, that would be great. But I don't know how you really do that.
I think that's a tough one, right? Like, and but you want like peak era David Ross when he was like, or like what's his face? Oh, what was the guy's name?
Who do you play for?
He played for the Mets. I'm blanking on his name. Was it Ramon Castro, right?
Ah, yes.
Ramon Castro was like, he didn't want to be an everyday starter. Like, he, and everyone, why does this guy not play every day? Because he could hit. And he just, it seemed like he was cool playing once every three games. And so, yeah, like that guy, like if you could resurrect Ramon Castro from wherever he was, that would be a good fit, you know, like a guy like that. But I think that there's not a lot of those guys out. It's a rare thing, a good hitting backup catcher, because if you're a good hitting backup catcher, you should be a starting catcher.
You're starting every day.
You
know? Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
You're right. I think that you can find someone who's better than Nito, right? Like, I think you can. There's got to be an in between spot there somewhere.
They had a guy named Travis d'Arnaud who's probably better than Nito, and we all know how that went.
Yeah, that was. I mean, if you talk about Brody's like botched jobs, like that, giving him arbitration in the contract and then cutting him like 2 weeks into the season is like, that is inexperience. That is like, he screwed that up.
Yes, absolutely. But I agree. I think that there is somebody out there who is an upgrade over Nito. I just don't know how much of an upgrade, and I don't know if the Mets are going to be savvy enough to get that player. But we'll see. We'll see about that. Is there anybody in particular you'd like to see in terms of a back end starter, or do you think there's any chance they go after Garrett Cole or someone of the like?
I don't think they're gonna go for Cole. Like, I don't think that there are too many teams who should want him that will spend way more money than them. Maybe they'll say they were going for Cole, but I don't think they can spend with the Yankees on that one. I don't think they can spend with the Angels on that one. And so, and those teams clearly want him. And so, like, they might say they made an offer to Garrett Cole, but they're not. I don't think they're going to get him. I'd love to be wrong. He's a great pitcher. I don't know. I haven't looked a ton at the sort of back end starter market. Yeah, it's a funny thing because it feels like the best way to play it now is to be like the smart team, you know, like you want to be the Astros and be the team that can find, that can identify something in Charlie Morton that makes him ready to be not just like capable, but awesome, you know, and a team like the A's where you can revive Edwin Jackson and Brett Anderson and get them, use them for five innings at a time, get value out of them by limiting them to two times through the order, and then, you know, turn it over to a really good bullpen. So I almost think that the fifth starter spot, like, it's now like this sort of like palette for teams' creativity. And I think it's like sort of a test for the Mets front office here. And I don't know that they're necessarily, they're obviously not going to hang with like the Rays and the Astros and teams like that in that department with how well they can, you know, identify talent and optimize it. But you should be able, like, if a well-run team's got to be able to find that guy, you have to be able to on the relative, at a relatively cheaply find those innings. Like, they're out there. They're, if you know what to look for, I think.
And especially because there are guys like Adam Guttridge in the front office who come with an impressive pedigree and a reputation for being able to be that smart front office person who can help you identify a diamond in the rough. But it just seems like there's this... The Wilpons have long had a hard-on for fame, where they want to get the most famous guy at any position to be mm-hmm. on their team. And that's exactly how you don't run a team when you're trying to get a smart deal out of somebody.
Right.
So I just hope that somebody in the front office can get in their ear and explain to them why it's better to go after, like you said, a Charlie Morton or someone who has a clear flaw, but you can find a way around it versus trying to find the cheapest busted up superstar.
I mean, I would guess, and again, this is not entirely informed. This is just sort of speculative. I would guess that what you're suggesting, like that they're sort of they're hard on for fame, as you put it, is the type of thing that trickles into. I like to keep things professional, but I actually don't have to anymore. I can just. I heard you curse earlier. I can say fuck on the podcast.
Yes,
it's amazing. I think that might be the first time that's happened. So
exclusive.
Yeah, that's it. I think that probably. That is a related issue because I think that you hire sort of like big name and sexy name front office guys to run your analytics department, but an analytics department needs more than the guy at the top. They need like people writing the computer programs and people entering the data and doing like I think that there's a big I think that there are. Large distinctions in the sizes of those departments across teams. And if I had to guess, I would say the Mets are not shelling out as much money as they could for, the type of comprehensive analytics department you probably want. Like if I had to guess, I'd say if you went and looked at how the Rays are doing things and how many dudes they have, or I should say people, but it is dudes. It should be people. But how many people they have working for them in that capacity, coding things, entering things, figuring things out. Like I have to imagine the Mets are not competitive in that department.
Yeah, I think you're probably correct about that, unfortunately. I think that the upshot for Mets fans with Beltran coming in, with the type of season they had, and with Brody at the helm is that, Brody did some dumb things this first year out. But I think that for the most part, he's still a very well-respected person. And you don't know, look, everyone's first year on the job is a bit rocky. So I think that there is still some optimism to be had there for Brody. And, they were a competent bullpen away from the Nationals not making the playoffs.
Right. That is exactly the case. Yeah. I'm like a little bit skeptical of Brody Van Wagenen still because of like how very much he looks like if you could imagine sort of the Wilpon sitting down in a meeting and being like, we need one of these like young Ivy League dudes in a suit who are slick and good at math and all that stuff.
And looks like Chris Isaac.
Right, and like Brody Van Wagenen walks in like to negotiate a new contract for Cespedes, and they're like, "There's our guy! Look at him, he's hot!" Right, and so like I think that like I almost hold his handsome looks against him, if that makes sense.
And I think you're just in a hair war with him personally.
Yeah, he's got good hair. I think it might be professional envy. He also sort of just came in. With a lot of bravado, right? Like with the so many moves right off the bat, and it felt like a lot of like it felt a little bit like some of those moves, like some of these moves. It's like I'm making moves just to be like, guess what, Brody's here, and so many of them involved. Like, come on, so many of them involved his own former players.
Yes,
and like I don't necessarily hate that he knows those guys. So like. Maybe that makes sense to some extent. Like if this guy is a good person and you know he's dedicated and you know what he's looking for. Like I don't know that's the worst aspect of it. It's just it wasn't always the best. I don't know. It wasn't always the best luck.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Hey,
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Hello, listener. I'm Sean Ramos Firm, host of Today Explained, Vox's daily news podcast. Every day, Monday through Friday, my team and I look at what's happening in the world. We pick one essential news story that defines our moment and ask smart people to help us understand it in about 20 minutes or less. It's the perfect way to start or end your day. Subscribe to Today Explained for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. It's from Stitcher and the Vox Media Podcast Network.
All right, so I have a quick game of over under for you to play here.
Yes.
We're gonna set it at 25 games, and we're gonna say Jed Lowry starts for 2020.
I was shocked to learn what was it, the last week of the season when he played?
Well, he pinch hit. He never played the field.
Yeah, but it was like wait a minute, he's back. I'll go over. He's got to go over. Over.
All right, same number. Yoenis Cespedes starts.
Under. I wish it would be over. I wish it would be way over. I love him and I miss him, but it's going to be under. I think under.
Okay. Let's put it at.
Remember how cool Yoenis Cespedes was?
Oh man,
bought a prized pig at auction and then he ate it. That guy rules. he's the coolest guy. He's like literally the coolest guy. I just want him playing and hitting monster homers. I hope he's okay. I hope he gets better. I don't know what's going on. I don't know. But just like I don't. It's like you forget he was even a thing. But man, that guy was awesome.
You want to know how cool Cespedes was? The Amazing Avenue staff and fan base can be a bit too cool for school at times, and we were gathering at a Midtown bar during every away playoff game in 2015, rather. Goodness gracious, 2005. And half the folks that showed up, half of these hipster baseball fans, were wearing compression sleeves. That's how cool Yoenis Cespedes was.
Yeah,
he got
right.
Dorks
yeah.
to buy compression sleeves.
The guy smokes Marlboro Reds. It's absurd. And he listens to sad cowboy music at his locker sometimes. It's just whatever's going on with this guy is complex and cool. And I just want to hang out with him. That's it. I just want to hang out with him. Yeah. I want to go to his ranch and party and ride his horse.
All right.
That's not a euphemism.
I didn't think it was. And
okay.
We all want to ride horses with Yoenis Cespedes.
Right.
We all want to be fake cowboys with him for a day.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Let's put it at three. Over under number of back cover. Back page headlines that are negative to Beltran before the All-Star break.
Oh, way over.
Okay. And final question. Let's call it 15 Robinson Cano home runs next year.
Over. I think Cano is going to have a really nice year next year. I think that he is a way better player than he was this season. I didn't hate that trade as much as most people did. It was a lot to give up, and it was a lot to take on. Cano, with or without the PEDs, even if you look after he came back from the suspension last year, he's really good. He's always been good. That was what we watched was his first subpar season of his entire career. I know he's getting up there in years. I think he's got some life left in the tank. I think that would be my bold prediction for the 2020 Mets is that Robinson Cano has a 20 to 25 homer year and a 120 OPS plus.
I think that sounds about right. My bold prediction for the year is that Brandon Nimmo is going to have the second highest OPS plus in the outfield.
Behind Conforto?
I think behind Conforto, yeah. But yeah. He's going to have a really, really solid season next year.
Yeah, I buy that. I think Nimmo is a really nice player. Like he obviously got off to the awful start last year and had the injury issues and stuff, but like I think he's a real major leaguer. I think that's a building block for the Mets.
Yeah. I can't help but feel optimistic about the team. You know, I'd feel more optimistic if the Nationals didn't just win the World Series. But I think so much of that team is walking.
Yeah, but now they're all leaving. Yeah, I mean, maybe not. I think they'll bring at least one of these guys back. Like they'll bring Strasburg or Rendon back probably. Mm-hmm. But can they bring them both back? And
they're also a very old team.
Yeah, they were a very old team. And it's not like they were a powerhouse, right? It's not like they were the Yankees or the Astros or the Dodgers, where it's like, oh, they're just going to win 100 games for the next 5 years. They were, I sort of liked the Nationals in spite of myself this year. They were a weirdly enjoyable team to watch, but, they were not. I don't think they bite. I don't think even, like, I don't know. I'm not know who to ask, but like, they were just not the best team ever or anything like right. that. Like they were the team that they were the classic example of your team that gets hot at exactly the right time.
Yes.
They were not nearly as good a team as the Astros, right? They beat them. Like that's baseball. Sometimes you the inferior team wins in a 7-game series. They yeah. won, all credit to them. That's the point, right? Like they won, but I don't think that if they played 162 games against the Astros, I think the Astros win more than half of them for sure.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I could not in good conscience root for the Nationals because I'm a Mets fan, but after the Osuna thing, I really didn't want to root for the Astros either. You know, it was a tough series, but I kind of resigned myself to the Nationals winning, and then they went to the White House and just proved the bad baseball stereotypes to be true.
I mean, that's the thing is like, and obviously the Osuna thing is like that is more than normal. That's bad. Like that was, and I was with you on that, but like there are going to be people you don't, I don't want to even say that because like, I don't want to compare what Osuna did to what like Kurt Suzuki did. That's not reasonable. but like, I just think like once you start putting too much stock and faith into like, oh, this guy's character versus this guy's character versus this guy's character, you know, and like letting that dictate how you root, like ultimately you're going to be disappointed because they're all just human people, right? Yeah. And so like obviously that's not to excuse Ozuna or that awful, like what a horribly handled flap that was, and like what an embarrassment and a disgrace for the Astros organization
and a disgrace for Major League Baseball.
Yeah, like I know Steph Epstein, like she's just like that's just not someone who that like obviously she's been vindicated, but like she's just not someone who is gonna like make up a story and put herself in the middle of it. It's just like that's not what happened there. Like I knew that like as soon as it came out, I was like, well, that's obviously not true. Like that, you know, and then like that she fabricated it, which is like just such a horrible thing to do, to be like that's your default. And like I'm you know, just that's your like your knee-jerk reaction is like, let's discredit the journalist who wrote this story about our horrible assistant vice president who is defending our horrible closer. So like that was all horrible. That said, like I do really enjoy watching Altuve and Bregman and Correa and Springer, and like those are all guys I have interacted with some and found very pleasant and smart and interesting, and so like I do kind of root for the Astros, so like it was like a 50-50 World Series for me.
Yeah, it was tough. But let's talk about something fun. You and I have tweeted a bit about our love of weird guitars, and so mm-hmm. I figure that music is something that you're.
You're a trombone man too, right?
I'm a what man? Sorry.
You play trombone as well.
I played tuba. I play a little bit of trombone, but I played tuba all through high school. Yes.
I think it's from your Twitter picture is you with a brass mouthpiece in right?
No, it's actually a beer. But
oh, it's a beer. I thought that was a trombone mouthpiece. That's what I had said.
Oh no, I'm sorry to disappoint, but not the case.
But you're still a lower brass man. At
yes,
heart.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. So you know, every week we do a music recommendation, and so Ted, you're the guest. What should folks be listening to this week?
Oh, man. Well, I was going to go a different direction, but because you brought up weird guitars, are you familiar with Charlie Hunter? Do you know who that is?
I have seen Charlie Hunter play a number of times, yes.
Yeah, so Charlie Hunter and, you know, so Charlie Hunter, for people who don't know, have you brought up Charlie Hunter on the show before?
If I have, it's been a couple of years, so I think you're safe.
Charlie Hunter is the most mind-blowing musician you can – one of the most mind-blowing musicians you will ever see live. He plays an eight-string guitar on which the bottom three strings are bass strings and the top five strings are traditional guitar strings. He has it tuned in sort of a funny way, but he basically plays the bass and the guitar at the same time, and he's not really like giving up much on either. Like he's like impossibly good at both instruments, and he's playing them simultaneously in like completely different rhythms and stuff. Like it's like if you play any instrument, but especially if you play the guitar or the bass or the guitar and the bass, and you go watch this guy, like you will spend the whole time just sort of like holding your head in your hands, wondering how this is possible.
It makes no sense.
And he's so good. Like I saw a show with him like years ago. I this is when I was in college. I interned at the Knitting Factory when it was in Manhattan. It was a show with like him and two other people in like a tiny little room in the Knitting Factory. And like in the middle of the show, one of the other guys just started calling out other guitar players' names, and he's just was like seamlessly going into different like styles of like playing like these other different guitar players. Just like a mind-blowingly good musician. Like he must have at some point just like looked at the guitar and been like, oh no, I've mastered this. I need to move on to something significantly more challenging. and so there's an album. This is obscure. I wasn't going to go nearly this obscure. But it's him and Stanton Moore, who is the drummer in the band Galactic, which again, like not a lot of people know, but he is these are all just extremely like top end talent guys. And one of my favorite musicians in the world is a saxophone player. That's how I learned about, I think this is how I learned about Charlie Hunter, learned about this album was through, a saxophone player named Skerrick, who played in Les Claypool's touring band for a while.
Fearless Flying Frog Brigade.
Yeah, yeah. He plays like electric saxophone, and so I was a trombone guy, and so as like a horn player in general, I just thought like the way he played the saxophone and ran it through guitar effects and ran it through a guitar amp and played sort of like metal saxophone, and I just thought that was the coolest thing. So like he in college, I like sort of like mimicked his setup a little bit for the trombone. So the three of them are on an album. And the album is Stanton Moore's, and it's called All Cooked Out. And the amount of sound they make it's all instrumental, but it's an incredible album. And it has like a couple songs on there that are just like there. It ranges from like the extremely funky to jazzy to like pretty heavy at times, and then like just completely beautiful at times. So I would go, that would be my music recommendation, would be to check out All Cooked Out. It's like a sort of a jazz funk album and Stanton Moore is the guy attributed to the album. Those same three would later become Garage Artois is the name of their outfit. But this was sort of their first, I think it was their first time that they all the three of them collaborated.
That's very cool. I saw him most recently in, let's call it 2015, at Ramapo College here in New Jersey. And I was one of maybe 25 people there. And he was playing in a duo with a drummer named Scott Amendola, who was another amazing drummer.
I have seen that guy as well. Yeah.
He plays with Nels Klein sometimes as well, Scott Amendola. Mm-hmm. And so it was an incredible show.
Yeah. It's a good time. It's like, I think it's like, it's almost like music for musicians a little bit, you know, like it, but it's, he's good. I mean, that guy's really freaking good.
Yeah.
So that was where I was going to go more toward my like traditional, I was gonna say Capital Punishment, the Big Pun album, just like as a throwback because it's so good, and like I feel like it's gotten lost in like everybody talks like Biggie, Tupac, like there's like the sort of standard like late 90s rap genre that everybody goes to, and that's not, I think, because it was like a slightly different thing. It doesn't fall in with the same like the Chronic and the and Enter the Wu-Tang and these like classic late 90s rap albums. It is like it hangs with all of them, and it is just like lyrically he is unbelievable. But that was where I was thinking because you had prepped me for this, but then once you brought up the guitar and weird guitars, I wanted to go to Charlie Hunter.
So I was trying to follow the weird guitar path that you set down for me, but I decided to be as iconoclastic as you were, but in a totally different direction. So were you a guy in high school who played like in the jazz band and the pit band and all that stuff?
Yes.
In high school?
Okay, yeah, so yeah. I did that in college too.
Okay. I was the bass player in my high school because I went to a very small high school. And so I wound up playing bass in the jazz band, the pit band, all of that. And I got to play in the pit for Oklahoma when that was the musical that was done in 1999. And so 20 years later it is back on Broadway, and earlier this summer, I was kind of walking around my house, and a song from Oklahoma popped in my head for the first time in like 20 years.
Which one?
It was, believe it or not, How Well Do You Know Oklahoma?
Embarrassingly well.
It's a Scandal, It's
which
an Outrage.
Which is not that well, but it's enough. Yeah. Well, which one?
It's a Scandal, It's an Outrage.
I don't remember that one.
Okay, do you remember the horrible Persian stereotype character?
Yes, because...
It's his song.
Yes, okay. Okay. So I saw Oklahoma put on by my high school when I was in – it was my sister was in it. It was my sister's freshman year.
Okay.
And so what's notable about that is that the guy who played Curly, who was a junior at the time, is Max von Essen, who is now like one of the biggest Broadway stars.
Yes.
And he went to my high school and sort of like he was like – it was like – like watching this guy in Oklahoma in high school was like what it was probably like watching Albert Pujols play high school baseball. Like
right.
He was just like, this guy is so clearly on another level. So it was like a very memorable thing, like just seeing that performance. And then next year they did Cabaret, which is insane.
Yes, it is that for high school to do.
Put that on in like 1995, but he was the MC in Cabaret, and like it really, really, really good.
So I'll get back to Oklahoma in a minute, I promise. But a friend of mine still does. He is a music director for high school musicals, and so occasionally I'll get the call, "Hey, can you play bass in this pit for me?" And a couple of years ago, I played bass in the pit for a Beauty and the Beast production, and the girl who was playing Belle was like, before he even said anything to me, I was like, "Who is that? That's going to be somebody." And she just finished filming West Side Story for Steven Spielberg. He had her playing Maria, and this is her first,
amazing.
Her first ever role is going to be in a Spielberg production of West Side Story. So, go ahead.
That is amazing. Can I tell you the best version of that story that I have personally?
Sure.
It's not that great, but it's just I played a Pee Wee football game when I was in fourth grade, and walking off the field, I said to my dad, I was like, "Remember that kid's name because he's going to be in the NFL someday." And the kid wound up making an NFL taxi squad. But I called it from fourth grade. I was like, "His name is Jeremiah Pope," because it was a very memorable name. And you look it up, he has like all the Long Island rushing records. And I was like, fourth grade. I was like, and I didn't say that about anyone else we ever played again. I was like, "That kid's going to the NFL. He is way better than everybody else on the field."
So I had that terrible Oklahoma song stuck in my head. It's the worst. It's probably the worst song in the show. But I had it, so I dug it up, and there's
that Poor Judd Is Dead song is pretty bad.
That's better than you think.
Okay,
revisit that. But anyway, so what I was going to say was, so then I, you know, one of my other side gigs that I do is I write about comic books and shit, and I've been reviewing the Watchmen TV show.
And I've seen the first three episodes. I just watched the episode 3 at the gym this morning.
I do a podcast on that show as well. But anyway, so the first episode features a lot of Oklahoma.
I was going to bring it up, that black Oklahoma in The Watchmen, yeah.
And so this is kind of the year of Oklahoma. So I sought out the new cast recording on Spotify, and they have taken an orchestra and turned it into a cowboy band that stays on stage the whole show. So it's just like an upright bass, guitar, a guy who's playing mandolin and banjo, and maybe and a fiddle player. That's it. And yeah. So it's really good. Like the cast recording is phenomenal. Because
that's cool.
Yeah, they pare it down to a really manageable, but really like down home country type band. And a play that I kind of enjoyed for nostalgic reasons. You know, I remember, you know, my best friend at the time was playing guitar next to me in the pits. We had a lot of fun with it, but I didn't think about the music all that much since then. And you listen to this and you're like, oh shit, Rodgers and Hammerstein know what they were doing. You know, this is a good show.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that is a strong opinion of mine, is that like covers in general are wildly underrated, and that like, I guess it's sort of like if you think about it in like the way like jazz musicians do, it's like it is you take the sort of like very stripped down basic aspects of the song, and then you rearrange it and you make it your own, and you know, different instrumentation and different arrangements and different rhythms or whatever, however you want to change the song, like you can stay true to the song and make it a whole new thing, and really you're just using the melody. And it's weird to me that like that is a stigmatized thing, like a cover song, because I think a cover song can be anything. Like I love the idea of like the taking, I mean, I could play you some like Les Mis songs on the acoustic guitar, and they sound cool because it's like this is a cool song. It's, you hear it only in this like very produced sort of lame musical theater way, but like musically it's just not a bad song, you know, and so like I love hearing things like that, like stripped down.
Definitely check it out. It's especially if there's a song called I Can't Say No, which is a very,
I remember it.
It's not aged very well in the 21st century.
No,
but the arrangement of it is so good. It's really amazingly tight and just super cool. But speaking of covers, are you familiar with The Bad Plus?
Oh yeah.
So I saw The Bad Plus in Prospect Park in like 05, let's call it. And
Did they play their Iron Man cover is like one of my favorite things ever.
The Iron Man cover where they do the inverted chords at the end and it's a major chord. But this is before their third record came out, and this cover is the only cover on their third record. But so they're playing, and they start playing this kind of traditional funky acoustic thing. And then it devolves into chaos, and you're just waiting for it, and you realize, oh, this is about to go into the melody of Chariots of Fire.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The fucking place erupted. It was as if the second coming happened.
Outrageously triumphant. Yes, the
place just went nuts, because you're so used to hearing this cheesy Vangelis version of it, and to have it brought into something that's more digestible, and then to be played by these three virtuosic musicians. It was just, oh man.
Well, and like the way that guy plays piano like no one else in the world, right? I know that cover, like, and he's got like his left hand is like going insane, and he's just playing like the very slow part on the right. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. So, you know, I agree with you. I think a well done cover can totally open your eyes to a song you used to ignore.
Right, and be like, you know what? That's actually a kind of a cool song. You know, when you're like, well, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I think we have probably broken Chris's brain, because Chris always picks some really good, like, stoner rock or something. And I love that stuff, too. But we picked an obscure jazz record and a Broadway cast recording. So, sorry, Chris. This is what happens when you skip out on the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong. Yeah, I say I'm pretty eclectic when it comes to music that I like. But the truth is now it's like, because of like digital media and Spotify, it's like I listen to the same 20 songs over and over again. It's so unfortunate.
I was just saying this, that when I was in high school, and I would, you know, work every job I could find to order a record I read about in a guitar magazine, I was listening to all this eclectic stuff. And now that I have the entire world's recorded history at my fingertips, I'm listening to the same Weezer and Beatles stuff I was listening to.
I don't know what to listen to, and I don't know how to get to it, and I don't, and it's just like, whatever. Like, here's my stupid playlist I have. I'll just listen to this again. Or like the radio, the Spotify radio function is bad, and it's like, I'll just use the Spotify radio function for this one.
Here is my Spotify pro tip. If you haven't done it yet, there's a section called Made for You, and they give you something called Discover Weekly. Mm-hmm. That playlist is good. The rest of it is trash. Discover Weekly is good.
And then a lot of it for me is now like songs that I like that my kid likes, which are rare because like mostly he likes Wheels on the Bus and Five Little Monkeys. And so I try to steer him towards like actual music, and he happens to love Sly and the Family Stone. It's just incredible. It was like I nearly cried the first time he asked our Google Home to play Sly and the Family Stone. So now we listen to a lot of like the Everyday People radio on Spotify.
My kids are really into the Beatles, which is predictable. Every kid is into the Beatles.
That's cool.
But also, we gotta, their favorite
not on
thing,
Spotify though, right? So
no,
so
they are I, now. They are
oh,
now.
Oh, they are now. Okay. Yeah.
But their big thing lately is, I don't know if you've seen the video for the Wilco song Everyone Hides, where the band plays hide and seek in the video.
Oh, no, I have not.
Like, for little kids, playing hide and seek is the best. So when they see six guys in their 50s playing hide and seek, they think it's the funniest thing in the world. At least once a day, my son walks up and says, "Everyone hides," and pulls my phone out and wants to watch it.
Amazing.
So he's into Wilco, so that's pretty
that's
cool,
great.
Too. For
that's
a three-year-old,
great.
That's pretty good.
That's great, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Ted,
I mean, you just want to avoid Wheels on the Bus as much as possible.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like, I hate to see that.
Baby Shark was a thing in my household for a little while, of course it was. But then it became a Nationals thing, and that's even worse. So.
Yeah. No, I know it.
So if people want to send you music recommendations and other stuff on the internet, where can they find you, Ted?
I'm on Twitter at OG Ted Berg. I am on Instagram, also at OG Ted Berg, on LinkedIn. I don't think it's at OG Ted Berg there. It's not the LinkedIn scene, you know.
I got former Met, one of everyone's favorite people, the best eyebrows in baseball, Josh Satin, on this podcast by LinkedIn. So yeah.
Nice. There you go. So I'm out and about on the internet. TedGotis.net is still up and running. I'm in the process, the very slow process of overhauling it. I'm hoping by sometime in the next couple of months, I'll have like a more professional looking version of that site.
So I'm on Twitter at Brian Needs an App, and I've been saving my sandwich question for the end here. But
yes.
So I recently was very excited by a sandwich I saw. It was a turkey and brie sandwich with a cranberry orange chutney on it and sliced green apples. It was supposed to be like an autumnal sandwich.
Yeah.
And the sliced green apples were sliced very thin, which I was afraid they were going to be just chunks of apple on there.
No, you don't want chunks of apple, yeah.
They were thinly sliced. However, I felt they just put way too many apples on the sandwich, and it was an overpowering flavor then. So my question for you is there a hard and fast rule for you with how much fruit belongs on a sandwich? And tomatoes don't count as fruit in this example.
No. I mean, I don't – I would say that I don't really want a fruit sandwich, right? Like, I don't want the fruit to be the main thing in the sandwich unless it's some fruit. I understand – do you ever had jackfruit? I've never had jackfruit, but I understand that that's like a fairly – like it's a versatile enough – thing that I don't even know what it tastes like, but I know people like say like, oh, you can substitute this for like barbecue pork and it will be just as good. I don't believe that.
I own a smoker. That's bullshit.
Right. I have heard people who are vegetarians insist that that is the case. It's not, but I've heard that. But I would say, yeah, like the fruit is – it's always going to be I had a sandwich recently that was that had like a cherry compote on it. It was a lamb burger with cherry on it, and that was really, really good. But the fruit is going to be such a strong flavor that I think you want like one layer. Like it's just got to be one thin layer of that fruit. If there's too many apples, then you're eating an apple sandwich. I would always just rather have an apple.
Yes.
But there's a solution to that problem, which is you just take off some of the apples.
Which is what I did, and it wound up being fine.
Then you have dessert, with your sandwich.
Yeah. You know, I have some other issues with the sandwich, but this isn't a sandwich podcast just yet. So,
if you ever wanted to be, you know where to go. You know who to call. I'm around.
Just speaking of lamb, random story, but I think you'll enjoy it. So, I was talking with another parent at drop off for my kid, my 3-year old's pre-K program, and she was saying, like, how good of an eater is your son? I was like, oh, he's not a very good eater at all. She goes, yeah, mine either. I sent him in with lamb last week, and he didn't even use the mint jelly. What monster of a parent sends lamb and mint jelly into a daycare?
That is pretty wild. That's pretty wild. Like, well, I mean, I don't know. We try at least to get our kid to eat whatever we're eating. Like, we will always present that as the first option.
Sure, and we do the same thing.
And then once he's not, if it's clear he's not eating it, then you try to go to plan B. So, like, maybe it was like, oh, like, he really enjoyed the lamb and mint jelly last night. But that seems like... just what about Cheerios? Like, just, you can always just send Cheerios, you know? I mean,
even if you eat it at home, to send that to daycare just seems like a mistake.
Yeah. I mean, it's like is someone going to heat that up for you? Or are you going to, that is weird.
That's a lunch I may not bring to my office.
And maybe you transition the kid into lamb via gyro, you know, find a more accessible lamb product to get him in there before you're going like full roasted lamb with mint jelly, like you're like my Scottish grandmother.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Ted, thank you for coming on the show. Listeners, we'll be back next week. We have lots of Amazing Avenue podcasts going up all season long. We'll have an Unformettable for you in a couple of days. And as always, let's go, Mets.
Peace.
Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.